She loved to put up lunches for him when he went hunting, to mend his ball gloves and sew buttons on his shooting coat, bake the kind of nut cake he liked, and fed his setter dog when he was away on trips with his father. Antonia had made herself cloth working slippers out of Mr. Hartley's old coats, and in these she went padding about after Charlie, fairly panting with eagerness to please him. Next to Charlie, I think she loved Nina best. Nina was only 6, and she was rather more complex than the other children. She was fanciful, had all sorts of unspoken preferences, and was easily offended. At the slightest disappointment or displeasure, her velvety brown eyes filled with tears, and she would lift her chin and walk silently away. If we ran after her and tried to appease her, it did no good. She walked on unmollified. I used to think that no eyes in the world could grow so large or hold so many tears as Nina's. Mrs. Hartling and Antonia invariably took her part. We were never given a chance to explain. The charge was simply, "You have made Nina cry. Now Jimmy can go home and Sally must get her arithmetic." I liked Nina too. She was so quaint and unexpected, and her eyes were lovely, but I often wanted to shake her. We had jolly evenings at the Hartlings when the father was away. If he was at home, the children had to go to bed early or they came over to my house to play. Mr. Hartling not only demanded a quiet house, he demanded all his wife's attention. He used to take her away to their room in the West L and talk over his business with her all evening. Though we did not realize it then, Mrs. Hartling was our audience when we played, and we always looked to her for suggestions. Nothing flattered one like her quick laugh. Mr. Hartling had a desk in his bedroom and his own easy chair by the window in which no one else ever sat. On the nights when he was at home, I could see his shadow on the blind, and it seemed to me an arrogant shadow. Mrs. Hartling paid no heed to anyone else if he was there. Before he went to bed, she always got him a lunch of smoked salmon or anchovies and beer. He kept an alcohol lamp in his room and a French coffee pot, and his wife made coffee for him at any hour of the night he happened to want it. Most Black Hawk fathers had no personal habits outside their domestic ones. They paid the bills, pushed the baby carriage after office hours, moved the sprinkler about over the lawn, and took the family driving on Sunday. Mr. Hartling, therefore, seemed to me autocratic and imperial in his ways. He walked, talked, put on his gloves, shook hands, like a man who felt that he had power. He was not tall, but he carried his head so haughtily that he looked a commanding figure, and there was something daring and challenging in his eyes. I used to imagine that the nobles, of whom Antonia was always talking, probably looked very much like Christian Hartling, wore caped overcoats like his, and just such a glittering diamond upon the little finger. Except when the father was at home, the Hartling house was never quiet. Mrs. Hartling and Nina and Antonia made as much noise as a houseful of children, and there was usually somebody at the piano. Julia was the only one who was held down to regular hours of practicing, but they all played. When Frances came home at noon, she played until dinner was ready. When Sally got back from school, she sat down in her hat and coat and drummed the plantation melodies that Negro minstrel troops brought to town. Even Nina played the Swedish wedding march. Mrs. Hartling had studied the piano under a good teacher, and somehow she managed to practice every day. I soon learned that if I were sent over on an errand and found Mrs. Hartling at the piano, I must sit down and wait quietly until she turned to me. I can see her at this moment, her short, square person planted firmly on the stool, her little fat hands moving quickly and neatly over the keys, her eyes fixed on the music with intelligent concentration. Chapter 4. "I won't have none of your weevily wheat, and I won't have none of your barley, but I'll take a measure of fine wheat flour to make a cake for Charlie." We were singing rhymes to tease Antonia while she was beating up one of Charlie's favorite cakes in her big mixing bowl. It was a crisp autumn evening, just cold enough to make one glad to quit playing tag in the yard and retreat into the kitchen. We had begun to roll popcorn balls with syrup when we heard a knock at the back door, and Tony dropped her spoon and went to open it. A plump, fair-skinned girl was standing in the doorway. She looked demure and pretty and made a graceful picture in her blue cashmere dress and little blue hat, with a plaid shawl drawn neatly about her shoulders and a clumsy pocketbook in her hand.
"Hello, Tony. Don't you know me?"
she asked in a smooth, low voice, looking in at us archly. Antonia gasped and stepped back.
"Why, it's Lena! Of course I didn't know you, so dressed up!"
Lena Lingard laughed, as if this pleased her. I had not recognized her for a moment either. I had never seen her before with a hat on her head, or with shoes and stockings on her feet, for that matter. And here she was, brushed and smoothed and dressed like a town girl, smiling at us with perfect composure.
"Hello, Jim," she said carelessly as she walked into the kitchen and looked about her. "I've come to town to work too, Tony." "Have you now? Well, ain't that funny?"
Antonia stood ill at ease and didn't seem to know just what to do with her visitor. The door was open into the dining room where Mrs. Harling sat crocheting and Frances was reading. Frances asked Lena to come in and join them.
"You are Lena Lingard, aren't you? I've been to see your mother, but you were off herding cattle that day. Mama, this is Chris Lingard's oldest daughter."
Mrs. Harling dropped her worsted and examined the visitor with quick, keen eyes. Lena was not at all disconcerted. She sat down in the chair Frances pointed out, carefully arranging her pocketbook and gray cotton gloves on her lap. We followed with our popcorn, but Antonia hung back, said she had to get her cake into the oven.
"So you have come to town?" said Mrs. Harling, her eyes still fixed on Lena. "Where are you working?"
"For Mrs. Thomas, the dressmaker. She is going to teach me to sew. She says I have quite a knack. I'm through with the farm. There ain't any end to the work on a farm, and always so much trouble happens. I'm going to be a dressmaker."
"Well, there have to be dressmakers. It's a good trade. But I wouldn't run down the farm if I were you," said Mrs. Harling rather severely. "How is your mother?"
"Oh, mother's never very well. She has too much to do. She'd get away from the farm, too, if she could. She was willing for me to come. After I learn to do sewing, I can make money and help her."
"See that you don't forget to," said Mrs. Harling skeptically, as she took up her crocheting again and sent the hook in and out with nimble fingers.
"No'm, I won't," said Lena blandly.
She took a few grains of the popcorn we pressed upon her, eating them discreetly and taking care not to get her fingers sticky. Frances drew her chair up nearer to the visitor.
"I thought you were going to be married, Lena," she said teasingly. "Didn't I hear that Nick Svensson was rushing you pretty hard?"
Lena looked up with her curiously innocent smile.
"He did go with me quite a while, but his father made a fuss about it and said he wouldn't give Nick any land if he married me, so he's going to marry Annie Iverson. I wouldn't like to be her. Nick's awful sullen, and he'll take it out on her. He ain't spoke to his father since he promised."
Frances laughed. "And how do you feel about it?"
"I don't want to marry Nick or any other man," Lena murmured. "I've seen a good deal of married life, and I don't care for it. I want to be so I can help my mother and the children at home, and not have to ask leave of anybody."
"That's right," said Frances. "And Mrs. Thomas thinks you can learn dressmaking?"
"Yes'm. I always liked to sew, but I never had much to do with. Mrs. Thomas makes lovely things for all the town ladies. Did you know Mrs. Gardner is having a purple velvet made? The velvet came from Omaha. My, but it's lovely."
Lena sighed softly and stroked her cashmere folds.
"Tony knows I never did like out-of-door work," she added.
Mrs. Harling glanced at her.
"I expect you'll learn to sew all right, Lena, if you'll only keep your head and not go gadding about to dances all the time and neglect your work the way some country girls do."
"Yes'm. Tiny Soderball is coming to town, too. She's going to work at the Boys' Home Hotel."
"She'll see lots of strangers," Lena added wistfully.
"Too many, like enough," said Mrs. Harling. "I don't think a hotel is a good place for a girl, though I guess Mrs. Gardner keeps an eye on her waitresses."
Lena's candid eyes, that always looked a little sleepy under their long lashes, kept straying about the cheerful rooms with naive admiration. Presently she drew on her cotton gloves.
"I guess I must be leaving," she said irresolutely.
Frances told her to come again whenever she was lonesome or wanted advice about anything. Lena replied that she didn't believe she would ever get lonesome in Black Hawk. She lingered at the kitchen door and begged Antonia to come and see her often.
"I've got a room of my own at Mrs. Thomas's, with a carpet."
Tony shuffled uneasily in her cloth slippers.
"I'll come sometime, but Mrs. Harling don't like to have me run much," she said evasively.
"You can do what you please when you go out, can't you?" Lena asked in a guarded whisper. "Ain't you crazy about town, Tony? I don't care what anybody says. I'm done with the farm."
She glanced back over her shoulder toward the dining room where Mrs. Harling sat. When Lena was gone, Frances asked Antonia why she hadn't been a little more cordial to her.
"I didn't know if your mother would like her coming here," said Antonia, looking troubled. "She was kind of talked about out there."
"Yes, I know. But Mother won't hold it against her if she behaves well here. You needn't say anything about that to the children. I guess Jim has heard all that gossip?" When I nodded, she pulled my hair and told me I knew too much anyhow. We were good friends, Frances and I. I ran home to tell Grandmother that Lena Lingard had come to town. We were glad of it, for she had a hard life on the farm. Lena lived in the Norwegian settlement west of Squaw Creek, and she used to herd her father's cattle in the open country between his place and the Shimerdas. Whenever we rode over in that direction, we saw her out among her cattle, bareheaded and barefooted, scantily dressed in tattered clothing, always knitting as she watched her herd. Before I knew Lena, I thought of her as something wild, that always lived on the prairie, because I had never seen her under a roof. Her yellow hair was burned to a ruddy thatch on her head, but her legs and arms, curiously enough, in spite of constant exposure to the sun, kept a miraculous whiteness which somehow made her seem more undressed than other girls who went scantily clad. The first time I stopped to talk to her, I was astonished at her soft voice and easy, gentle ways. The girls out there usually got rough and mannish after they went to herding. But Lena asked Jake and me to get off our horses and stay a while, and behaved exactly as if she were in a house and were accustomed to having visitors. She was not embarrassed by her ragged clothes, and treated us as if we were old acquaintances. Even then I noticed the unusual color of her eyes, a shade of deep violet, and their soft, confiding expression. Chris Lingard was not a very successful farmer, and he had a large family. Lena was always knitting stockings for little brothers and sisters, and even the Norwegian women, who disapproved of her, admitted that she was a good daughter to her mother. As Tony said, she had been talked about. She was accused of making Ole Benson lose the little sense he had, and that at an age when she should still have been in pinafores. Ole lived in a leaky dugout somewhere at the edge of the settlement. He was fat and lazy and discouraged, and bad luck had become a habit with him. After he had had every kind of misfortune, his wife, Crazy Mary, tried to set a neighbor's barn on fire and was sent to the asylum at Lincoln. She was kept there for a few months, then escaped and walked all the way home, nearly 200 miles, traveling by night and hiding in barns and haystacks by day. When she got back to the Norwegian settlement, her poor feet were as hard as hoofs. She promised to be good and was allowed to stay at home, though everyone realized she was as crazy as ever, and she still ran about barefooted through the snow, telling her domestic troubles to her neighbors. Not long after Mary came back from the asylum, I heard a young Dane, who was helping us to thresh, tell Jake and Otto that Chris Lingard's oldest girl had put Ole Benson out of his head until he had no more sense than his crazy wife. When Ole was cultivating his corn that summer, he used to get discouraged in the field, tie up his team, and wander off to wherever Lena Lingard was herding. There he would sit down on the draw side and help her watch her cattle. All the settlement was talking about it. The Norwegian preacher's wife went to Lena and told her that she ought not to allow this. She begged Lena to come to church on Sundays. Lena said she hadn't a dress in the world any less ragged than the one on her back. Then the minister's wife went through her old trunks and found some things she had worn before her marriage. The next Sunday, Lena appeared at church, a little late, with her hair done up neatly on her head, like a young woman, wearing shoes and stockings, and the new dress, which she had made over for herself very becomingly. The congregation stared at her. Until that morning, no one, unless it were Ole, had realized how pretty she was, or that she was growing up. The swelling lines of her figure had been hidden under the shapeless rags she wore in the fields. After the last hymn had been sung and the congregation was dismissed, Ole slipped out to the hitch bar and lifted Lena on her horse. That, in itself, was shocking. A married man was not expected to do such things. But it was nothing to the scene that followed. Crazy Mary darted out from the group of women at the church door and ran down the road after Lena, shouting horrible threats.
"Look out, you Lena Lingard, look out! I'll come over with a corn knife one day and trim some of that shape off you. Then you won't sail around so fine, making eyes at the men."
The Norwegian women didn't know where to look. They were formal housewives, most of them, with a severe sense of decorum.
But Lena Lingard only laughed her lazy, good-natured laugh and rode on, gazing back over her shoulder at Oli's infuriated wife. The time came, however, when Lena didn't laugh. More than once, Crazy Mary chased her across the prairie and round the Schemerder's cornfield. Lena never told her father. Perhaps she was ashamed. Perhaps she was more afraid of his anger than of the corn knife. I was at the Schemerder's one afternoon when Lena came bounding through the red grass as fast as her white legs could carry her. She ran straight into the house and hid in Antonia's feather bed. Mary was not far behind. She came right up to the door and made us feel how sharp her blade was, showing us very graphically just what she meant to do to Lena. Mrs. Schemerder, leaning out of the window, enjoyed the situation keenly, and was sorry when Antonia sent Mary away, mollified by an apron full of bottled tomatoes. Lena came out from Tony's room behind the kitchen, very pink from the heat of the feathers, but otherwise calm. She begged Antonia and me to go with her and help get her cattle together. They were scattered and might be gorging themselves in somebody's cornfield.
"Maybe you lose a steer and learn not to make some things with your eyes at married men,"
Mrs. Schemerder told her hectoringly. Lena only smiled her sleepy smile. "I never made anything to him with my eyes. I can't help it if he hangs around, and I can't order him off. It ain't my prairie."
Chapter 5. After Lena came to Blackhawk, I often met her downtown, where she would be matching sewing silk or buying findings for Mrs. Thomas. If I happened to walk home with her, she told me all about the dresses she was helping to make, or about what she saw and heard when she was with Tiny Soderball at the hotel on Saturday nights. The Boys' Home was the best hotel on our branch of the Burlington, and all the commercial travelers in that territory tried to get into Black Hawk for Sunday. They used to assemble in the parlor after supper on Saturday nights. Marshall Field's man, Anson Kirkpatrick, played the piano and sang all the latest sentimental songs. After Tiny had helped the cook wash the dishes, she and Lena sat on the other side of the double doors between the parlor and the dining room, listening to the music and giggling at the jokes and stories. Lena often said she hoped I would be a traveling man when I grew up. They had a gay life of it. Nothing to do but ride about on trains all day and go to theaters when they were in big cities. Behind the hotel, there was an old store building, where the salesmen opened their big trunks and spread out their samples on the counters. The Black Hawk merchants went to look at these things and order goods, and Mrs. Thomas, though she was retail trade, was permitted to see them and to get ideas. They were all generous, these traveling men. They gave Tiny Soderball handkerchiefs and gloves and ribbons and striped stockings, and so many bottles of perfume and cakes of scented soap that she bestowed some of them on Lena. One afternoon in the week before Christmas, I came upon Lena and her funny, square-headed little brother Chris standing before the drugstore, gazing in at the wax dolls and blocks and Noah's Arks arranged in the frosty show window. The boy had come to town with a neighbor to do his Christmas shopping, for he had money of his own this year. He was only 12, but that winter he had got the job of sweeping out the Norwegian church and making the fire in it every Sunday morning. A cold job it must have been, too. We went into Duckford's dry goods store, and Chris unwrapped all his presents and showed them to me. Something for each of the six younger than himself, even a rubber pig for the baby. Lena had given him one of Tiny Soderball's bottles of perfume for his mother, and he thought he would get some handkerchiefs to go with it. They were cheap, and he hadn't much money left. We found a table full of handkerchiefs spread out for view at Duckford's. Chris wanted those with initial letters in the corner, because he had never seen any before. He studied them seriously, while Lena looked over his shoulder, telling him she thought the red letters would hold their color best. He seemed so perplexed that I thought perhaps he hadn't enough money after all. Presently, he said gravely,
"Sister, you know Mother's name is Bertha. I don't know if I ought to get B for Bertha or M for Mother."
Lena patted his bristly head.
"I'd get the B, Chrissy. It will please her for you to think about her name. Nobody ever calls her by it now."
That satisfied him. His face cleared at once, and he took 3 reds and 3 blues. When the neighbor came in to say that it was time to start, Lena wound Chris's comforter about his neck and turned up his jacket collar. He had no overcoat. And we watched him climb into the wagon and start on his long, cold drive. As we walked together up the windy street, Lena wiped her eyes with the back of her woolen glove.
"I get awful homesick for them, all the same," she murmured.
as if she were answering some remembered reproach. Chapter 6. Winter comes down savagely over a little town on the prairie. The wind that sweeps in from the open country strips away all the leafy screens that hide one yard from another in summer, and the houses seem to draw closer together. The roofs that look so far away across the green treetops now stare you in the face, and they are so much uglier than when their angles were softened by vines and shrubs. In the morning, when I was fighting my way to school against the wind, I couldn't see anything but the road in front of me. But in the late afternoon, when I was coming home, the town looked bleak and desolate to me. The pale cold light of the winter sunset did not beautify. It was like the light of truth itself. When the smoky clouds hung low in the west and the red sun went down behind them, leaving a pink flush on the snowy roofs and the blue drifts, then the wind sprang up afresh with a kind of bitter song, as if it said, "This is reality, whether you like it or not. All those frivolities of summer, the light and shadow, the living mask of green that trembled over everything, they were lies, and this is what was underneath. This is the truth." It was as if we were being punished for loving the loveliness of summer. If I loitered on the playground after school, or I went to the post office for the mail and lingered to hear the gossip about the cigar stand, it would be growing dark by the time I came home. The sun was gone. The frozen streets stretched long and blue before me. The lights were shining pale in kitchen windows, and I could smell the suppers cooking as I passed. Few people were abroad, and each one of them was hurrying toward a fire. The glowing stoves in the houses were like magnets. When one passed an old man, one could see nothing of his face but a red nose sticking out between a frosted beard and a long plush cap. The young men capered along with their hands in their pockets and sometimes tried a slide on the icy sidewalk. The children, in their bright hoods and comforters, never walked but always ran from the moment they left their door, beating their mittens against their sides. When I got as far as the Methodist church, I was about halfway home. I can remember how glad I was when there happened to be a light in the church, and the painted glass window shone out at us as we came along the frozen street. In the winter bleakness, a hunger for color came over people, like the Laplanders craving for fats and sugar. Without knowing why, we used to linger on the sidewalk outside the church when the lamps were lighted early for choir practice or prayer meeting, shivering and talking until our feet were like lumps of ice. The crude reds and greens and blues of that colored glass held us there. On winter nights, the lights in the Harlings' windows drew me like the painted glass. Inside that warm, roomy house, there was color, too. After supper, I used to catch up my cap, stick my hands in my pockets, and dive through the willow hedge as if witches were after me. Of course, if Mr. Harling was at home, if his shadow stood out on the blind of the west room, I did not go in, but turned and walked home by the long way, through the street, wondering what book I should read as I sat down with the two old people. Such disappointments only gave greater zest to the nights when we acted charades, or had a costume ball in the back parlor, with Sally always dressed like a boy. Frances taught us to dance that winter, and she said, from the first lesson, that Antonia would make the best dancer among us. On Saturday nights, Mrs. Harling used to play the old operas for us, Martha, Norma, Rigoletto, telling us the story while she played. Every Saturday night was like a party. The parlor, the back parlor, and the dining room were warm and brightly lighted, with comfortable chairs and sofas and gay pictures on the walls. One always felt at ease there. Antonia brought her sewing and sat with us. She was already beginning to make pretty clothes for herself. After the long winter evenings on the prairie, with Ambrosia's sullen silences and her mother's complaints, the Harlings' house seemed, as she said, like heaven to her. She was never too tired to make taffy or chocolate cookies for us. If Sally whispered in her ear, or Charlie gave her three winks, Tony would rush into the kitchen and build a fire in the range on which she had already cooked three meals that day. While we sat in the kitchen waiting for the cookies to bake or the taffy to cool, Nina used to coax Antonia to tell her stories about the calf that broke its leg, or how Yulka saved her little turkeys from drowning in the freshet, or about old Christmases and weddings in Bohemia. Nina interpreted the stories about the creche fancifully, and in spite of our derision, she cherished a belief that Christ was born in Bohemia a short time before the Schemerders left that country. We all liked Tony's stories.
Her voice had a peculiarly engaging quality. It was deep, a little husky, and one always heard the breath vibrating behind it. Everything she said seemed to come right out of her heart. One evening, when we were picking out kernels for walnut taffy, Tony told us a new story.
"Mrs. Harling, did you ever hear about what happened up in the Norwegian settlement last summer, when I was threshing there? We were at Iverson's, and I was driving one of the grain wagons."
Mrs. Harling came out and sat down among us.
"Could you throw the wheat into the bin yourself, Tony?"
She knew what heavy work it was.
"Yes, ma'am, I did. I could shovel just as fast as that fat Andern boy that drove the other wagon. One day, it was just awful hot. When we got back to the field from dinner, we took things kind of easy. The men put in the horses and got the machine going, and Ole Iverson was up on the deck, cutting bands. I was sitting against a straw stack, trying to get some shade. My wagon wasn't going out first, and somehow I felt the heat awful that day. The sun was so hot like it was going to burn the world up. After a while, I see a man coming across this stubble, and when he got close, I see it was a tramp. His toes stuck out of his shoes, and he hadn't shaved for a long while, and his eyes was awful red and wild like he had some sickness. He comes right up and begins to talk like he knows me already. He says, 'The ponds in this country is done got so low a man couldn't drown himself in one of them.' I told him nobody wanted to drown themselves, but if we didn't have rain soon, we'd have to pump water for the cattle. 'Oh, cattle,' he says. 'You all take care of your cattle. Ain't you got no beer here?' I told him he'd have to go to the Bohemians for beer. The Norwegians didn't have none when they threshed. 'My God,' he says, 'so it's Norwegians now, is it? I thought this was Ameriki.' Then he goes up to the machine and yells out to Ole Iverson, 'Hello, partner, let me up there. I can cut bands and I'm tired of tramping. I won't go no farther.' I tried to make signs to Ole, 'cause I thought that man was crazy and might get the machine stopped up. But Ole, he was glad to get down out of the sun and chaff. It gets down your neck and sticks to you something awful when it's hot like that. So Ole jumped down and crawled under one of the wagons for shade, and the tramp got on the machine. He cut bands all right for a few minutes, and then, Mrs. Harling, he waved his hand to me and jumped headfirst right into the threshing machine after the wheat. I begun to scream, and the men run to stop the horses, but the belt had sucked him down, and by the time they got her stopped, he was all beat and cut to pieces. He was wedged in so tight it was a hard job to get him out, and the machine ain't never worked right since.' 'Was he clear dead, Tony?' we cried. 'Was he dead? Well, I guess so. There, now, Nina's all upset. We won't talk about it. Don't you cry, Nina. No old tramp won't get you while Tony's here.'
Mrs. Harling spoke up sternly.
'Stop crying, Nina, or I'll always send you upstairs when Antonia tells us about the country. Did they never find out where he came from, Antonia?'
'Never, ma'am. He hadn't been seen nowhere except in a little town they call Conway. He tried to get beer there, but there wasn't any saloon. Maybe he came in on a freight, but the brakeman hadn't seen him. They couldn't find no letters nor nothing on him. Nothing but an old penknife in his pocket and the wishbone of a chicken wrapped up in a piece of paper and some poetry.'
'Some poetry?' we exclaimed.
'I remember,' said Francis. 'It was the old oaken bucket, cut out of a newspaper and nearly worn out. Ole Iverson brought it into the office and showed it to me.'
'Now, wasn't that strange, Miss Francis?' Tony asked thoughtfully. 'What would anybody want to kill themselves in summer for? In threshing time, too. It's nice everywhere then.'
"So it is, Antonia," said Mrs. Harling heartily.
"Maybe I'll go home and help you thresh next summer. Isn't that taffy nearly ready to eat? I've been smelling it a long while."
There was a basic harmony between Antonia and her mistress. They had strong, independent natures, both of them. They knew what they liked and were not always trying to imitate other people. They loved children and animals and music and rough play and digging in the earth. They liked to prepare rich, hearty food and to see people eat it, to make up soft white beds and to see youngsters asleep in them. They ridiculed conceited people and were quick to help unfortunate ones. Deep down in each of them there was a kind of hearty joviality, a relish of life, not over-delicate, but very invigorating. I never tried to define it, but I was distinctly conscious of it.
I could not imagine Antonia's living for a week in any other house in Black Hawk than the Harlings. Chapter 7. Winter lies too long in country towns, hangs on until it is stale and shabby, old and sullen. On the farm, the weather was the great fact, and men's affairs went on underneath it as the streams creep under the ice. But in Black Hawk, the scene of human life was spread out shrunken and pinched, frozen down to the bare stalk. Through January and February, I went to the river with the Harlings on clear nights, and we skated up to the big island and made bonfires on the frozen sand. But by March, the ice was rough and choppy, and the snow on the river bluffs was gray and mournful-looking. I was tired of school, tired of winter clothes, of the rutted streets, of the dirty drifts and the piles of cinders that had lain in the yard so long. There was only one break in the dreary monotony of that month, when Blind D'Arnaud, the Negro pianist, came to town. He gave a concert at the opera house on Monday night, and he and his manager spent Saturday and Sunday at our comfortable hotel. Mrs. Harling had known D'Arnaud for years. She told Antonia she had better go to see Tiny that Saturday evening, as there would certainly be music at the boys' home. Saturday night, after supper, I ran downtown to the hotel and slipped quietly into the parlor. The chairs and sofas were already occupied, and the air smelled pleasantly of cigar smoke. The parlor had once been two rooms, and the floor was sway-backed where the partition had been cut away. The wind from without made waves in the long carpet. A coal stove glowed at either end of the room, and the grand piano in the middle stood open. There was an atmosphere of unusual freedom about the house that night, for Mrs. Gardner had gone to Omaha for a week. Johnny had been having drinks with the guests until he was rather absent-minded. It was Mrs. Gardner who ran the business and looked after everything. Her husband stood at the desk and welcomed incoming travelers. He was a popular fellow, but no manager. Mrs. Gardner was admittedly the best-dressed woman in Black Hawk, drove the best horse, and had a smart trap and a little white-and-gold sleigh. She seemed indifferent to her possessions, was not half so solicitous about them as her friends were. She was tall, dark, severe, with something Indian-like in the rigid immobility of her face. Her manner was cold, and she talked little. Guests felt that they were receiving, not conferring, a favor when they stayed at her house. Even the smartest traveling men were flattered when Mrs. Gardner stopped to chat with them for a moment. The patrons of the hotel were divided into two classes, those who had seen Mrs. Gardner's diamonds and those who had not. When I stole into the parlor, Anson Kirkpatrick, Marshall Field's man, was at the piano playing airs from a musical comedy then running in Chicago. He was a dapper little Irishman, very vain, homely as a monkey, with friends everywhere and a sweetheart in every port, like a sailor. I did not know all the men who were sitting about, but I recognized a furniture salesman from Kansas City, a drug man, and Willie O'Reilly, who traveled for a jewelry house and sold musical instruments. The talk was all about good and bad hotels, actors and actresses, and musical prodigies. I learned that Mrs. Gardner had gone to Omaha to hear Booth and Barrett, who were to play there next week, and that Mary Anderson was having a great success in A Winter's Tale in London. The door from the office opened, and Johnny Gardner came in, directing Blind D'Arnaud. He would never consent to be led. He was a heavy, bulky mulatto on short legs, and he came tapping the floor in front of him with his gold-headed cane. His yellow face was lifted in the light, with a show of white teeth, all grinning, and his shrunken, papery eyelids lay motionless over his blind eyes.
"Good evening, gentlemen. No ladies here? Good evening, gentlemen. We're going to have a little music? Some of you gentlemen going to play for me this evening?"
It was the soft, amiable Negro voice, like those I remembered from early childhood, with the note of docile subservience in it. He had the Negro head, too, almost no head at all. Nothing behind the ears but folds of neck under close-clipped wool. He would have been repulsive if his face had not been so kindly and happy. It was the happiest face I had seen since I left Virginia. He felt his way directly to the piano. The moment he sat down, I noticed the nervous infirmity of which Mrs. Harling had told me. When he was sitting or standing still, he swayed back and forth incessantly like a rocking toy. At the piano, he swayed in time to the music, and when he was not playing, his body kept up this motion like an empty mill grinding on. He found the pedals and tried them,
ran his yellow hands up and down the keys a few times, tinkling off scales, then turned to the company.
"She seems all right, gentlemen. Nothing happened to her since the last time I was here. Mrs. Gardner, she always has this piano tuned up before I come. Now, gentlemen, I expect you've all got grand voices. Seems like we might have some good old plantation songs tonight."
The men gathered round him as he began to play "My Old Kentucky Home." They sang one Negro melody after another, while the mulatto sat rocking himself, his head thrown back, his yellow face lifted, his shriveled eyelids never fluttering. He was born in the far South, on the D'Arnaud plantation, where the spirit, if not the fact, of slavery persisted. When he was 3 weeks old, he had an illness which left him totally blind. As soon as he was old enough to sit up alone and toddle about, another affliction, the nervous motion of his body, became apparent. His mother, a buxom young Negro wench who was laundress for the D'Arnauds, concluded that her blind baby was not right in his head, and she was ashamed of him. She loved him devotedly, but he was so ugly with his sunken eyes and his fidgets that she hid him away from people. All the dainties she brought down from the big house were for the blind child, and she beat and cuffed her other children whenever she found them teasing him or trying to get his chicken bone away from him. He began to talk early, remembered everything he heard, and his mammy said he wasn't all wrong. She named him Samson because he was blind, but on the plantation he was known as Yellow Martha's Simple Child. He was docile and obedient, but when he was 6 years old he began to run away from home, always taking the same direction. He felt his way through the lilacs, along the boxwood hedge, up to the south wing of the big house where Miss Nellie D'Arnaud practiced the piano every morning. This angered his mother more than anything else he could have done. She was so ashamed of his ugliness that she couldn't bear to have white folks see him. Whenever she caught him slipping away from the cabin, she whipped him unmercifully and told him what dreadful things old Mr. D'Arnaud would do to him if he ever found him near the big house. But the next time Samson had a chance, he ran away again. If Miss D'Arnaud stopped practicing for a moment and went toward the window, she saw this hideous little pickaninny, dressed in an old piece of sacking, standing in the open space between the hollyhock rows, his body rocking automatically, his blind face lifted to the sun and wearing an expression of idiotic rapture. Often she was tempted to tell Martha that the child must be kept at home, but somehow the memory of his foolish, happy face deterred her. She remembered that his sense of hearing was nearly all he had, though it did not occur to her that he might have more of it than other children. One day Samson was standing thus while Miss Nellie was playing her lesson to her music teacher. The windows were open. He heard them get up from the piano, talk a little while, and then leave the room. He heard the door close after them. He crept up to the front windows and stuck his head in. There was no one there. He could always detect the presence of anyone in a room. He put one foot over the window sill and straddled it. His mother had told him over and over how his master would give him to the big mastiff if he ever found him meddling. Samson had got too near the mastiff's kennel once and had felt his terrible breath in his face. He thought about that, but he pulled in his other foot. Through the dark he found his way to the thing, to its mouth. He touched it softly, and it answered softly, kindly. He shivered and stood still. Then he began to feel it all over, ran his fingertips along the slippery sides, embraced the carved legs, tried to get some conception of its shape and size, of the space it occupied in primeval night. It was cold and hard, and like nothing else in his black universe. He went back to its mouth, began at one end of the keyboard, and felt his way down into the mellow thunder as far as he could go. He seemed to know that it must be done with the fingers, not with the fists or the feet. He approached this highly artificial instrument through a mere instinct and coupled himself to it, as if he knew it was to piece him out and make a whole creature of him. After he had tried over all the sounds, he began to finger out passages from things Miss Nellie had been practicing, passages that were already his, that lay under the bone of his pinched, conical little skull, definite as animal desires. The door opened. Miss Nellie and her music master stood behind it, but blind Samson, who was so sensitive to presences, did not know they were there. He was feeling out the pattern that lay already made on the big and little keys. When he paused for a moment, because the sound was wrong and he wanted another, Miss Nellie spoke softly. He whirled about in a spasm of terror, leaped forward in the dark, struck his head on the open window, and fell screaming and bleeding to the floor. He had what his mother called a fit. The doctor came and gave him opium. When Samson was well again, his young mistress led him back to the piano. Several teachers experimented with him. They found he had absolute pitch and a remarkable memory. As a very young child, he could repeat, after a fashion, any composition that was played for him. No matter how many wrong notes he struck, he never lost the intention of a passage. He brought the substance of it across by irregular and astonishing means. He wore his teachers out. He could never learn like other people, never acquired any finish. He was always a Negro prodigy who played barbarously and wonderfully. As piano playing, it was perhaps abominable, but as music, it was something real, vitalized by a sense of rhythm that was stronger than his other physical senses, that not only filled his dark mind, but worried his body incessantly. To hear him, to watch him, was to see a Negro enjoying himself as only a Negro can. It was as if all the agreeable sensations possible to creatures of flesh and blood were heaped up on those black and white keys, and he were gloating over them and trickling them through his yellow fingers. In the middle of a crashing waltz, D'Arnaud suddenly began to play softly, and, turning to one of the men who stood behind him, whispered, "Somebody dancing in there." He jerked his bullet head toward the dining room. "I hear little feet. Girls, I expect." Anson Kirkpatrick mounted a chair and peeped over the transom. Springing down, he wrenched open the doors and ran out into the dining room. Tiny and Lena, Antonia and Mary Jusick, were waltzing in the middle of the floor. They separated and fled toward the kitchen, giggling. Kirkpatrick caught Tiny by the elbows. "What's the matter with you girls, dancing out here by yourselves when there's a room full of lonesome men on the other side of the partition? Introduce me to your friends, Tiny." The girls, still laughing, were trying to escape. Tiny looked alarmed. "Mrs. Gardner wouldn't like it," she protested. "She'd be awful mad if you was to come out here and dance with us." "Mrs. Gardner's in Omaha, girl. Now you're Lena, are you? And you're Tony, and you're Mary. Have I got you all straight?" O'Reilly and the others began to pile the chairs on the tables. Johnny Gardner ran in from the office. "Easy, boys, easy," he entreated them. "You'll wake the cook, and there'll be the devil to pay for me. She won't hear the music, but she'll be down the minute anything's moved in the dining room." "Oh, what do you care, Johnny? Fire the cook and wire Molly to bring another. Come along, nobody'll tell tales." Johnny shook his head. "'S a fact, boys," he said confidentially. "If I take a drink in Black Hawk, Molly knows it in Omaha." His guests laughed and slapped him on the shoulder. "Ah, we'll make it all right with Molly. Get your back up, Johnny." Molly was Mrs. Gardner's name, of course. Molly Bawn was painted in large blue letters on the glossy white sides of the hotel bus, and Molly was engraved inside Johnny's ring and on his watch case, doubtless on his heart, too. He was an affectionate little man, and he thought his wife a wonderful woman. He knew that without her he would hardly be more than a clerk in some other man's hotel. At a word from Kirkpatrick, D'Arnaud spread himself out over the piano and began to draw the dance music out of it, while the perspiration shone on his short wool and on his uplifted face. He looked like some glistening African god of pleasure, full of strong, savage blood. Whenever the dancers paused to change partners or to catch breath, he would boom out softly, "Who's that going back on me? One of these city gentlemen, I bet. Now, you girls, you ain't going to let that floor get cold." Antonia seemed frightened at first, and kept looking questioningly at Lena and Tiny over Willie O'Reilly's shoulder. Tiny Sodaball was trim and slender, with lively little feet and pretty ankles. She wore her dresses very short. She was quicker in speech, lighter in movement and manner than the other girls. Mary Jusick was broad and brown of countenance, slightly marked by smallpox, but handsome for all that. She had beautiful chestnut hair, coils of it. Her forehead was low and smooth, and her commanding dark eyes regarded the world indifferently and fearlessly. She looked bold and resourceful and unscrupulous, and she was all of these. They were handsome girls, had the fresh color of their country upbringing, and in their eyes that brilliancy which is called, by no metaphor, alas, the light of youth. D'Arnaud played until his manager came and shut the piano. Before he left us, he showed us his gold watch which struck the hours, and a topaz ring given him by some Russian nobleman who delighted in Negro melodies and had heard D'Arnaud play in New Orleans. At last he tapped his way upstairs, after bowing to everybody, docile and happy. I walked home with Antonia. We were so excited that we dreaded to go to bed. We lingered a long while at the Harling's gate, whispering in the cold until the restlessness was slowly chilled out of us. Chapter 8. The Harling children and I were never happier, never felt more contented and secure, than in the weeks of spring which broke that long winter. We were out all day in the thin sunshine, helping Mrs. Harling and Tony break the ground and plant the garden, dig around the orchard trees, tie up vines, and clip the hedges. Every morning, before I was up, I could hear Tony singing in the garden rose. After the apple and cherry trees broke into bloom, we ran about under them, hunting for the new nests the birds were building, throwing clods at each other, and playing hide-and-seek with Nina. Yet the summer which was to change everything was coming nearer every day. When boys and girls are growing up, life can't stand still, not even in the quietest of country towns. And they have to grow up, whether they will or no. That is what their elders are always forgetting. It must have been in June, for Mrs. Harling and Antonia were preserving cherries when I stopped one morning to tell them that a dancing pavilion had come to town. I had seen two drays hauling the canvas and painted poles up from the depot. That afternoon, three cheerful-looking Italians strolled about Black Hawk looking at everything, and with them was a dark, stout woman who wore a long gold watch chain about her neck and carried a black lace parasol. They seemed especially interested in children and vacant lots. When I overtook them and stopped to say a word, I found them affable and confiding. They told me they worked in Kansas City in the winter, and in summer they went out among the farming towns with their tent and taught dancing. When business fell off in one place, they moved on to another. The dancing pavilion was put up near the Danish laundry, on a vacant lot surrounded by tall, arched cottonwood trees. It was very much like a merry-go-round tent, with open sides and gay flags flying from the poles. Before the week was over, all the ambitious mothers were sending their children to the afternoon dancing class. At 3 o'clock, one met little girls in white dresses and little boys in the round-colored shirts of the time, hurrying along the sidewalk on their way to the tent. Mrs. Vanny received them at the entrance, always dressed in lavender with a great deal of black lace, her important watch chain lying on her bosom. She wore her hair on the top of her head, built up in a black tower with red coral combs. When she smiled, she showed two rows of strong, crooked yellow teeth. She taught the little children herself, and her husband, the harpist, taught the older ones. Often the mothers brought their fancy work and sat on the shady side of the tent during the lesson. The popcorn man wheeled his glass wagon under the big cottonwood by the door and lounged in the sun, sure of a good trade when the dancing was over. Mr. Jensen, the Danish laundryman, used to bring a chair from his porch and sit out in the grass plot. Some ragged little boys from the depot sold pop and iced lemonade under a white umbrella at the corner and made faces at the spruce youngsters who came to dance. That vacant lot soon became the most cheerful place in town. Even on the hottest afternoons, the cottonwoods made a rustling shade, and the air smelled of popcorn and melted butter and bouncing bets wilting in the sun. Those hardy flowers had run away from the laundryman's garden, and the grass in the middle of the lot was pink with them. The Vannies kept exemplary order and closed every evening at the hour suggested by the city council. When Mrs. Vanny gave the signal and the harp struck up Home Sweet Home, all Black Hawk knew it was 10 o'clock. You could set your watch by that tune as confidently as by the roundhouse whistle. At last there was something to do in those long, empty summer evenings when the married people sat like images on their front porches and the boys and girls tramped and tramped the board sidewalks, northward to the edge of the open prairie, south to the depot, then back again to the post office, the ice cream parlor, the butcher shop. Now there was a place where the girls could wear their new dresses, and where one could laugh aloud without being reproved by the ensuing silence. That silence seemed to ooze out of the ground, to hang under the foliage of the black maple trees with the bats and shadows. Now it was broken by light-hearted sounds. First the deep purring of Mr. Vanny's harp came in silvery ripples through the blackness of the dusty-smelling night. Then the violins fell in. One of them was almost like a flute. They called so archly, so seductively, that our feet hurried toward the tent of themselves. Why hadn't we a tent before? Dancing became popular now, just as roller skating had been the summer before. The Progressive Euchre Club arranged with the Vannies for the exclusive use of the floor on Tuesday and Friday nights. At other times, anyone could dance who paid his money and was orderly. The railroad men, the roundhouse mechanics, the delivery boys, the iceman, the farmhands who lived near enough to ride into town after their day's work was over. I never missed a Saturday night dance. The tent was open until midnight then. The country boys came in from farms 8 and 10 miles away, and all the country girls were on the floor, Antonia and Lena and Tiny, and the Danish laundry girls and their friends. I was not the only boy who found these dances gayer than the others. The young men who belonged to the Progressive Euchre Club used to drop in late and risk a tiff with their sweethearts and general condemnation for a waltz with the hired girls. Chapter 9. There was a curious social situation in Black Hawk. All the young men felt the attraction of the fine, well-set-up country girls who had come to town to earn a living, and, in nearly every case, to help the father struggle out of debt or to make it possible for the younger children of the family to go to school. Those girls had grown up in the first bitter hard times and had got little schooling themselves. But the younger brothers and sisters for whom they made such sacrifices and who have had advantages never seem to me, when I meet them now, half as interesting or as well educated. The older girls, who helped to break up the wild sod, learned so much from life, from poverty, from their mothers and grandmothers. They had all, like Antonia, been early awakened and made observant by coming at a tender age from an old country to a new. I can remember a score of these country girls who were in service in Black Hawk during the few years I lived there, and I can remember something unusual and engaging about each of them. Physically, they were almost a race apart, and out-of-door work had given them a vigor which, when they got over their first shyness on coming to town, developed into a positive carriage and freedom of movement, and made them conspicuous among Black Hawk women. That was before the day of high school athletics. Girls who had to walk more than half a mile to school were pitied. There was not a tennis court in the town. Physical exercise was thought rather inelegant for the daughters of well-to-do families. Some of the high school girls were jolly and pretty, but they stayed indoors in winter because of the cold, and in summer because of the heat. When one danced with them, their bodies never moved inside their clothes. Their muscles seemed to ask but one thing, not to be disturbed. I remember those girls merely as faces in the schoolroom, gay and rosy, or listless and dull, cut off below the shoulders, like cherubs, by the ink-smeared tops of the high desks that were surely put there to make us round-shouldered and hollow-chested. The daughters of Black Hawk merchants had a confident, uninquiring belief that they were refined, and that the country girls who worked out were not. The American farmers in our county were quite as hard-pressed as their neighbors from other countries. All alike had come to Nebraska with little capital and no knowledge of the soil they must subdue. All had borrowed money on their land. But no matter in what straits the Pennsylvanian or Virginian found himself, he would not let his daughters go out into service. Unless his girls could teach a country school, they sat at home in poverty. The Bohemian and Scandinavian girls could not get positions as teachers because they had had no opportunity to learn the language. Determined to help in the struggle to clear the homestead from debt, they had no alternative but to go into service. Some of them, after they came to town, remained as serious and as discreet in behavior as they had been when they plowed and herded on their father's farm. Others, like the three Bohemian Marys, tried to make up for the years of youth they had lost. But every one of them did what she had set out to do, and sent home those hard-earned dollars. The girls I knew were always helping to pay for plows and reapers, brood sows or steers to fatten. One result of this family solidarity was that the foreign farmers in our county were the first to become prosperous. After the fathers were out of debt, the daughters married the sons of neighbors, usually of like nationality, and the girls who once worked in Black Hawk kitchens are today managing big farms and fine families of their own. Their children are better off than the children of the town women they used to serve. I thought the attitude of the town people toward these girls very stupid. If I told my schoolmates that Lena Lindgaard's grandfather was a clergyman, and much respected in Norway, they looked at me blankly. What did it matter? All foreigners were ignorant people who couldn't speak English. There was not a man in Blackhawk who had the intelligence or cultivation, much less the personal distinction, of Antonia's father. Yet people saw no difference between her and the three Marys. They were all Bohemians, all hired girls. I always knew I should live long enough to see my country girls come into their own, and I have. Today, the best that a harassed Blackhawk merchant can hope for is to sell provisions and farm machinery and automobiles to the rich farms where that first crop of stalwart Bohemian and Scandinavian girls are now the mistresses. The Blackhawk boys looked forward to marrying Blackhawk girls and living in a brand new little house with best chairs that must not be sat upon and hand-painted china that must not be used. But sometimes a young fellow would look up from his ledger or out through the grating of his father's bank and let his eyes follow Lena Lingard as she passed the window with her slow, undulating walk, or Tiny Soderball tripping by in her short skirt and striped stockings. The country girls were considered a menace to the social order. Their beauty shone out too boldly against a conventional background. But anxious mothers need have felt no alarm. They mistook the mettle of their sons. The respect for respectability was stronger than any desire in Black Hawk youth. Our young man of position was like the son of a royal house. The boy who swept out his office or drove his delivery wagon might frolic with the jolly country girls, but he himself must sit all evening in a plush parlor where conversation dragged so perceptibly that the father often came in and made blundering efforts to warm up the atmosphere. On his way home from his dull call, he would perhaps meet Tony and Lena coming along the sidewalk, whispering to each other, or the three Bohemian Marys in their long plush coats and caps, comporting themselves with a dignity that only made their eventful histories the more piquant. If he went to the hotel to see a traveling man on business, there was Tiny, arching her shoulders at him like a kitten. If he went into the laundry to get his collars, there were the four Danish girls, smiling up from their ironing boards, with their white throats and their pink cheeks. The three Marys were the heroines of a cycle of scandalous stories, which the old men were fond of relating as they sat about the cigar stand in the drugstore. Mary Dusick had been housekeeper for a bachelor rancher from Boston, and after several years in his service she was forced to retire from the world for a short time. Later she came back to town to take the place of her friend, Mary Svoboda, who was similarly embarrassed. The three Marys were considered as dangerous as high explosives to have about the kitchen, yet they were such good cooks and such admirable housekeepers that they never had to look for a place. The Vanny's tent brought the town boys and the country girls together on neutral ground. Sylvester Lovett, who was cashier in his father's bank, always found his way to the tent on Saturday night. He took all the dances Lena Lingard would give him, and even grew bold enough to walk home with her. If his sisters or their friends happened to be among the onlookers on popular nights, Sylvester stood back in the shadow under the cottonwood trees, smoking and watching Lena with a harassed expression. Several times I stumbled upon him there in the dark, and I felt rather sorry for him. He reminded me of Ole Benson, who used to sit on the draw side and watch Lena herd her cattle. Later in the summer, when Lena went home for a week to visit her mother, I heard from Antonia that young Lovett drove all the way out there to see her and took her buggy riding. In my ingenuousness, I hoped that Sylvester would marry Lena, and thus give all the country girls a better position in the town. Sylvester dallied about Lena until he began to make mistakes in his work, had to stay at the bank until after dark to make his books balance. He was daft about her, and everyone knew it. To escape from his predicament, he ran away with a widow 6 years older than himself, who owned a half-section. This remedy worked, apparently. He never looked at Lena again, nor lifted his eyes as he ceremoniously tipped his hat when he happened to meet her on the sidewalk. So that was what they were like, I thought, these white-handed, high-colored clerks and bookkeepers. I used to glare at young Lovett from a distance and only wished I had some way of showing my contempt for him. Chapter 10. It was at the Vanny's tent that Antonia was discovered. Hitherto she had been looked upon more as a ward of the Harlings than as one of the hired girls. She had lived in their house and yard and garden. Her thoughts never seemed to stray outside that little kingdom. But after the tent came to town, she began to go about with Tiny and Lena and their friends. The Vannies often said that Antonia was the best dancer of them all. I sometimes heard murmurs in the crowd outside the pavilion that Mrs. Harling would soon have her hands full with that girl. The young men began to joke with each other about the Harling's Tony, as they did about the Marshal's Anna or the gardener's Tiny. Antonia talked and thought of nothing but the tent. She hummed the dance tunes all day. When supper was late, she hurried with her dishes, dropped and smashed them in her excitement. At the first call of music, she became irresponsible. If she hadn't time to dress, she merely flung off her apron and shot out of the kitchen door. Sometimes I went with her. The moment the lighted tent came into view, she would break into a run like a boy. There were always partners waiting for her. She began to dance before she got her breath. Antonia's success at the tent had its consequences. The iceman lingered too long now when he came into the covered porch to fill the refrigerator. The delivery boys hung about the kitchen when they brought the groceries. Young farmers who were in town for Saturday came tramping through the yard to the back door to engage dances or to invite Tony to parties and picnics. Lena and Norwegian Anna dropped in to help her with her work so that she could get away early. The boys who brought her home after the dances sometimes laughed at the back gate and wakened Mr. Harley from his first sleep. A crisis was inevitable. One Saturday night, Mr. Harling had gone down to the cellar for beer. As he came up the stairs in the dark, he heard scuffling on the back porch and then the sound of a vigorous slap. He looked out through the side door in time to see a pair of long legs vaulting over the picket fence. Antonia was standing there, angry and excited. Young Harry Payne, who was to marry his employer's daughter on Monday, had come to the tent with a crowd of friends and danced all evening. Afterward, he begged Antonia to let him walk home with her. She said she supposed he was a nice young man, as he was one of Miss Frances's friends, and she didn't mind. On the back porch, he tried to kiss her, and when she protested, because he was going to be married on Monday, he caught her and kissed her until she got one hand free and slapped him. Mr. Harling put his beer bottles down on the table.
"This is what I've been expecting, Antonia. You've been going with girls who have a reputation for being free and easy, and now you've got the same reputation. I won't have this and that fellow tramping about my backyard all the time. This is the end of it, tonight. It stops. Short. You can quit going to these dances or you can hunt another place. Think it over."
The next morning, when Mrs. Harling and Frances tried to reason with Antonia, they found her agitated but determined.
"Stop going to the tent," she panted. "I wouldn't think of it for a minute. My own father couldn't make me stop. Mr. Harling ain't my boss outside my work. I won't give up my friends, either. The boys I go with are nice fellows. I thought Mr. Payne was all right, too, because he used to come here. I guess I gave him a red face for his wedding, all right,"
she blazed out indignantly.
"You'll have to do one thing or the other, Antonia," Mrs. Harling told her decidedly. "I can't go back on what Mr. Harling has said. This is his house.